being offended, figures out how to help him, how to cover things over, and make him and everyone else comfortable. She provides a feeling of safety, which for him has powerful appeal since his life is becoming unmanageable. When Elaine joined Al-Anon and learned to stop actually helping Tom stay sick by covering up for him, he did what many addicts do when their partners begin to recover. He retaliated as dramatically as he could, and since for every male alcoholic, there are plenty of female codependents looking for someone to save, he quickly found Elaine's replacement, another woman who was willing to continue the kind of rescuing and enabling that Elaine now refused to do for him. He also got so much sicker that his choices narrowed down to two: to begin to recover, or to die. Only when his alternatives were that bleak did he become willing to change. The relationship is currently intact, owing to both these people's involvement in the anonymous programs, AA for Tom, Al-Anon for Elaine. There, they are learning for the first time in their lives to relate to each other in a healthy, non-manipulative way. Charles, 65, retired civil engineer with two children, divorced, remarried, and now widowed.
Helen has been dead for 2 years now, and I'm finally beginning to sort it all out. I never thought I'd see a therapist, not at my age, but after her death I was so angry it scared me. I couldn't stop feeling I wanted to hurt her. I had dreams about hitting her, and I'd wake up yelling at her. I thought I was going crazy. Finally, I got the nerve to tell my doctor. He's as old and conservative as I am, so when he told me I'd better get some counseling, I swallowed my pride and did it. I contacted the hospice people in town, and they put me in touch with a therapist who specializes in helping people get through grief. Well, we worked on my grief, and it still kept coming up as anger. So finally, I started accepting that I was mad as hell, and began with the help of the therapist to look at why. Helen was my second wife. My first wife, Janet, still lives here in town with her new husband. I guess new is a funny word to use. All this happened 25 years ago. I met Helen when I was a civil engineer for the county. She was a secretary in the planning department, and I used to see her at work sometimes, and maybe once or twice a week at lunchtime in a little coffee shop downtown. She was a very pretty woman, always beautifully dressed, and a little shy, but friendly too. I could tell she liked me just by the way she looked at me and smiled. I guess I was a little flattered that she noticed me. I knew she was divorced with two kids, and I felt kind of sorry for her, having to raise them all alone. Anyway, one day I offered to buy her coffee, and we had a nice little talk. I made it clear I was married, but I guess I griped a little bit too much about some of the frustrations of married life. I still don't know how she managed to convey the message that day that I was too wonderful a man to ever be unhappy. But I left that coffee shop feeling 10 feet tall and wanting to see her again, wanting to feel the way she had made me feel, appreciated. Maybe it was because she didn't have a man in her life and she missed that, but I sure felt big and strong and special after our little talk. Still, I had no intention of getting involved. I'd never done anything like that before. I'd come out of the army after the war and settled down with the wife I'd left waiting for me. Janet and I weren't the happiest couple, but we weren't the unhappiest either. I never thought I'd run around on her. Helen had been married twice before and had suffered a lot in each marriage. Both men had walked out on her, and she'd had a child by each. Now she was raising her children alone without any support. The worst thing we could have done was get involved with each other. I felt so sorry for her, but I knew that I had nothing to offer her. In those days you couldn't get a divorce just 'cause you wanted one, and I certainly didn't make enough money to lose everything I had and then start over with another family to support in addition to my own. Besides, I really didn't want a divorce. I wasn't crazy about my wife anymore, but I loved my kids, and I liked what we all had together. All that began to change, though, as Helen and I continued to see each other. Neither of us could quit. Helen was lonely and said she'd rather have a little bit of me than nothing, and I knew she meant it. Once I had begun with Helen, there was no way out without hurting someone terribly. Pretty soon I felt like the worst kind of heel. Both these women were counting on me, and I was letting both of them down. Helen was mad about me. She'd do anything to see me. When I tried to break it off, I'd see her at work, and her sweet, sad face would just break my heart. Well, after a year or so, Janet found out about us and told me to stop seeing Helen or leave. I tried to stop, but couldn't stick to it. Besides, everything between Janet and me was so different now. There seemed to be less reason than ever to let go of Helen. It's a long story. Helen and I had a 9-year affair while my wife tried very hard first to keep me in the marriage and then to punish me for leaving her. Helen and I lived together on and off several times during those years until Janet finally got tired and agreed to a divorce. I still hate to think about what it did to all of us. In those days, people did not just live together. I think I really lost all my pride during those years. I was ashamed for myself, for my kids, for Helen and her kids, even for Janet, who had never done anything to deserve all this. Finally, after Janet quit fighting it and the divorce was final, Helen and I got married. But something was different between us as soon as the divorce was in the works. All those years, Helen had been warm and loving and seductive, very seductive. Of course I loved it. All that loving was what kept me with her, in spite of the pain to my kids, my wife, her, and her kids, all of us. She made me feel like the most desirable man in the world. Of course, we had fought before we got married because the tension was terrible, but our fights always ended with lovemaking, and I felt more wanted and needed and cared for than I ever had in my life. Somehow, what Helen and I had together seemed so special, so right, that the price we were paying almost seemed worth it. But when we finally could be together and begin to hold our heads up, Helen cooled off. She still went to work looking great, but at home she was careless about her appearance. I didn't mind, but I did notice. And sex slowed way down. She wasn't interested anymore. I tried not to pressure her, but it was frustrating to me. I was finally feeling less guilty and more ready to really enjoy being with her both at home and out in the world, and she was pulling away. Within 2 years, we had separate bedrooms, and it went on like that, cool and distant, until she died. I never really thought of leaving. I'd paid such a price to be with her. How could I? When I look back, I realize that Helen suffered probably more than I did through all those years of our affair. She never really knew whether I'd leave Janet or leave her. She used to cry a lot, and a couple of times she threatened suicide. She hated being the other woman. But as awful as those years before our marriage were, they were more loving and caring and exciting and special than anything afterward. I felt like such a failure after we married, that somehow I couldn't make her happy now that most of our problems were behind us. I came to understand a lot about myself in therapy, but I believe I also became willing to look at some things about Helen I hadn't wanted to face. She functioned better under all the strain and pressure and secretiveness of our affair than she did when things were more normal. That's why the love between us died as soon as the affair was over and the marriage began. When I could look at all this honestly, I began to get over the terrible anger I'd felt toward her since her death. I was angry because being with Helen had cost me so much. My marriage, in many ways my children's love, and the respect of my friends. I guess I felt like I'd been cheated.
Charles's attraction to Helen. Beautiful and alluring when they first met, Helen soon provided Charles with sexual bliss, blind devotion, and love bordering on reverence. His strong attraction to her, in spite of a stable, fairly satisfying marriage, hardly requires an explanation or justification. Quite simply, Helen made it her life's work from the beginning and throughout all the long years of their affair to deepen Charles's love for her and to make bearable and even worthwhile his long struggle to be free of his marriage. What does merit explanation is Helen's sudden and patent disinterest in the man for whom she had waited and suffered so long, once he was finally able to freely share a life with her. Why did she love him to distraction while he was married and quickly tire of him when he was not? Because Helen wanted only what she couldn't really have. To tolerate sustained interaction with a man personally and sexually, she needed the guarantee of distance and unattainability that Charles's marriage supplied. Only under those conditions was she able to give herself to him. She could not comfortably endure a genuine partnership that could, freed of the racking pressures of his marriage, develop and deepen on a basis other than their mutual struggle against the world. Helen needed the excitement, tension, and emotional pain of loving an unavailable man in order to relate at all. She had virtually no capacity for intimacy, or even much tenderness, once she was no longer embroiled in the struggle to win Charles. Having been won, he was virtually discarded. Yet through those long years of waiting for him, she gave every appearance of being a woman who loved too much. She genuinely suffered, pined, wept, and wailed for the man she loved but could not truly have. She experienced him as the center of her being, the most important force in her world, until she had him. Then the reality of him as a partner, with the bittersweet romance of their illicit affair removed, failed to rouse her to the thrills of passion she'd enjoyed for 9 years with this same man. Often it is observed that when two people who have been involved for years finally make a commitment to marry each other, something goes out of the relationship. The excitement is lost, and they fall out of love. That this happens is not necessarily because they have stopped trying to please each other. It may be because one or the other or both of them have overstepped their capacity for intimacy by making that very commitment. An open-ended relationship provides the promise of safety from deeper intimacy. With commitment, there is often emotional withdrawal in an effort toward self-protection. This is precisely what happened between Helen and Charles. Charles, for his part, ignored whatever signs there were of Helen's lack of emotional depth because of the flattery he felt from her attention. Far from being a passive victim of her machinations and manipulations, Charles actively refused to acknowledge the part of Helen's character that didn't fit with the view of himself, a view she had fostered and he wanted to believe, that he was enormously lovable and sexually irresistible. He lived in a carefully constructed fantasy world with Helen for many years, unwilling to puncture the illusion his ego had grown to cherish. Much of his anger after Helen's death was at himself, as he belatedly admitted his own denial and the role he had played in creating and perpetuating the fantasy of an all-consuming love, which finally resulted in the most sterile of marriages. Russell, 32, licensed social worker, having received a pardon from the governor, who designs community programs for youthful offenders.
The kids I work with are always impressed with that tattoo of my name on my left forearm. It says a lot about the way I used to live. I got it done when I was 17 because I was sure that someday I was going to be lying on the ground dead, and nobody would know who I was. I thought I was a hell of a bad guy. I lived with my mother till I was 7. Then she remarried and her new husband and I didn't get along. I ran away a lot, and in those days they locked you up for that. First it was juvenile hall, then foster homes, and more trips to juvenile hall. Pretty soon it was boys camp and then YA, the youth authority. As I got older, I was in and out of the local jails and finally prison. By the time I was 25, I had been in every kind of correctional facility the state of California had to offer, from forest camp to maximum security. Needless to say, I spent a lot more time locked up than I did on the outside during those years. But I still managed to meet Monica. One night in San Jose, a buddy I knew from YA and I were cruising around in this borrowed car. We pulled into a hamburger drive-in and parked next to these two girls. We got to talking and joking with them, and pretty soon we were sitting in the back seat of their car. Well, my buddy was a real ladies' man. He had the coolest line, so whenever there were girls around, I let him do all the talking. He could always get a couple of girls interested, but he also got first pick because he was so slick and did all the work, and I'd have second choice. I had no complaints that night because he paired off with this sexy little blonde who was driving, and I ended up with Monica. She was 15, really pretty, all soft and wide-eyed and interested. She had this really sweet way right from the beginning of caring so much. Now, when you've done time, you learn that there are some women who'll think you're a creep and have nothing to do with you. But there are others who get turned on by the whole idea. It fascinates them. They see you as big and bad, and they get real seductive trying to tame you. Or they think you've been hurt, and they feel sorry for you and want to help you. Monica was definitely in the category of wanting to help. She was a real nice girl, too. No heavy stuff right away. While my buddy was making it with her girlfriend, Monica and I took a walk in the moonlight and talked. She wanted to know everything about me. I cleaned up my story quite a bit so I wouldn't scare her off, and I told her a lot of the sad things, like how much my stepfather hated me and some of the crummy foster homes I'd been in where they gave me hand-me-downs and spent the money meant for me on their own kids. While I was talking, she squeezed my hand real hard and patted it, and even got tears in her big brown eyes. Man, by the time we said goodbye that night, I was in love. My buddy wanted to tell me every juicy detail of his big score with the blonde, and I didn't even want to listen. Monica had given me her address and phone number, and I was going to call her the next day for sure, but as we were driving out of the city, we got stopped by the cops because the car was hot. All I could think about was Monica. I was sure that was the end of it because I'd told her how hard I was trying to clean up my act and go straight. When I was back in YA, I decided to take a chance and write her. I told her I was doing time again, but for something I didn't do, that the cops had arrested me because I had a record and they didn't like me. Monica wrote right back and kept on writing me just about every day for the next 2 years. All we ever wrote each other about was how much we were in love, how much we missed each other, and what we would do together when I got out. Her mother wouldn't let her meet me in Stockton when I was released, so I took a bus back to San Jose. I was so excited about seeing her again, but really scared about it, too. I guess I was afraid she wouldn't want me after all. So instead of going to see her right away, I looked up some old buddies, and one thing led to another. We started raising hell, and by the time they finally drove me to Monica's house, 4 days had gone by. I was pretty wrecked. I'd had to get loaded just to have the courage to come see her. I was so afraid she'd tell me to get lost. Her mother was at work, thank God, when the guys dumped me on her sidewalk. Monica came out smiling, so glad to see me, even though she hadn't heard from me since I'd hit town. I remember that we went for another of our great walks that day as soon as I wasn't so high. I didn't have any money to take her anywhere, and no car either, but she didn't seem to mind then, or ever. For a long time, I could do no wrong in Monica's eyes. She made excuses for everything I did and didn't do. I was in and out of jail, and then prison for years, and she still married me and stuck by me. Her own dad had deserted the family when she was just a little kid. Her mother was real bitter about that, and she didn't like me too well either. In fact, that's why Monica and I got married. Once, when I'd been busted for bad checks and forgery, her mom wouldn't let Monica see me when I was out on bail, so we ran off together and got married. Monica was 18 then. We lived in a hotel for a little while until my trial. She had a job as a waitress, but she quit so she could come to court every day during the trial. Then, of course, I went to prison, and Monica went back home to her mom. They fought so much that she left and moved to the town nearest the prison, and worked as a waitress again. It was a college town, and I always hoped she'd go back to school. She really liked school, and she was so bright. But she said she didn't want to, she just wanted to wait for me. We'd write, and she'd come visit as often as they'd let her. She talked to the prison chaplain about me a lot, kept asking him to talk to me and help me, until I finally asked her not to do that anymore. I hated talking to the guy. I just couldn't relate. Even though she visited, she kept on writing, too, and she'd send all these books and articles about improving yourself. She told me constantly that she was praying for me to change. I wanted to stay out of prison, but I'd been doing time for so long, it was all I knew how to do. Well, finally something clicked inside me, and I got involved in a program to help me make it out there in the world. I went to school while I was on the inside, and learned to trade. Plus, I finished high school and started on my college education. When I got out, I somehow stayed out of trouble and continued with my education until I had a master's degree in social work. But along the way, I lost my wife. At first, when we were really struggling to make it, we got along okay, but as things got easier and we began to achieve what we'd always hoped for, Monica got angrier and snappier than I'd ever seen her in all those years through all those troubles. She left me just when we should have been happiest. I don't even know where she is now. Her mother won't tell me, and I finally decided that it wasn't my business to look for her if she didn't want to be with me. Sometimes I think it was a lot easier for Monica to love an idea of me than to love me in person. We were so in love when we were barely even together, when all we had were letters and visits and the dream of what we'd have someday. When I started making what we'd wished for a reality, we fell apart. The more middle class we became, the less she liked it. I guess she couldn't feel sorry for me anymore.
Russell's attraction to Monica. Nothing in Russell's background prepared him to be emotionally or even physically present to another person in a loving, committed relationship. For most of his life, he had actively been seeking a feeling of strength and safety by either running away or engaging in dangerous escapades. Through these highly distracting, tension-generating activities, he sought to avoid his own despair. He used involvement in danger to avoid feeling pain and helplessness at having been emotionally abandoned by his mother. When he met Monica, he was enchanted by her softly appealing looks and her tender attitude toward him. Rather than rejecting him for being bad, she responded to his problems with sincere interest and deep compassion. She immediately communicated that she was willing to be there for him, and it wasn't long before he tested her staying power. When he disappeared, Monica responded by patiently waiting. She seemed to have enough love, stability, and endurance to handle whatever Russell might do. Though it appears that Monica had a great measure of tolerance for Russell and his behavior, actually the exact opposite was true. What neither of these young people consciously realized was that she could be there for him only as long as he was not there for her. As long as he was separated from her, Russell found in Monica the perfect partner, the ideal prisoner's wife. She willingly spent her life waiting and hoping that he would change, and that then they could be together. Prison wives like Monica present perhaps the ultimate example of women who love too much. Because they are incapable of any degree of intimacy with a man, they choose instead to live with a fantasy, a dream of how much they will love and be loved someday when their partner changes and becomes available to them. But they can be intimate only in fantasy. When Russell accomplished the nearly impossible and began to go straight and stay out of jail, Monica drifted away. Having him present in her life demanded a threatening level of intimacy. It made her far more uncomfortable than his absence ever had. Nor could day-to-day reality with Russell ever compete with the idealized vision of mutual love she had entertained. There is a saying among convicts that they all have their Cadillacs parked at the curb waiting for them, meaning they entertain an overly idealized version of what life will be like for them when they are back on the streets. In the imagination of prisoners' wives like Monica, what is probably parked at the curb is not the Cadillac symbolizing money and power, but a coach, drawn by 6 white horses, representing magically romantic love. How these women will love and be loved, that is their dream. Along with their convict husbands, they usually find it easier to live with the dream than to struggle to try to make it come true in the real world. What is important to understand is that it appeared that Russell was unable to love with much depth, while Monica, with all her patience and compassion, seemed to be very good at it. In fact, they were both equally deficient in the ability to love intimately. That is why they became partners when they couldn't be together, and why when they could be together, their relationship had to end. It is instructive to note that Russell does not have a new partner in his life at this time. He, too, is still struggling with intimacy. Tyler, 42, business executive, divorced, no children.
I used to make a joke when we were still together and tell people that when I first saw Nancy, my heart was pounding so hard that I couldn't catch my breath. It was true. She was a nurse who worked for the firm where I'm employed, and I was in her office on a treadmill, having my respiratory system checked. That's what all the heart pounding and heavy breathing was about. I had been sent in by my superior because I gained so much weight, and also because I had been having some pains in my chest. Actually, I was in terrible shape. My wife had left me a year and a half before for another man, and while I know that starts a lot of guys running to the bars at night, I just stayed home and watched TV and ate. I had always liked to eat. My wife and I had played a lot of tennis, and I guess that had taken care of the calories when we were together. But with her gone, playing tennis depressed me. Hell, everything depressed me. That day in Nancy's office, I learned I'd gained 65 pounds in 18 months. I'd never even bothered to weigh myself, though I'd gone through several sizes of clothes. I just didn't care. Nancy was all business at first, telling me how serious the weight gain was and what I'd have to do to get rid of it, but I was feeling like an old man, and I really didn't want to make the effort to change. I guess I just felt sorry for myself. Even my ex, when she'd see me, would scold me and say, "How can you let yourself go like this?" I half hoped she'd come back to save me, but she didn't. Nancy asked me if there was any precipitating event tied in with my weight gain. When I told her about the divorce, she stopped being quite so professional and patted my hand sympathetically. I remember I felt a little thrill when she did that, and it was special because I hadn't felt much of anything for anybody for a very long time. She advised a diet and gave me lots of pamphlets and charts and told me to come back once every 2 weeks so she could see how I was doing. I couldn't wait to get back there. The 2 weeks went by and I hadn't followed the diet or lost any weight, but I sure had gained her sympathy. She and I spent my entire second appointment talking about how the divorce had affected me. She listened and then urged me to do all the things everybody tells you to do. Go to classes, join a health club, take a trip with the group, develop new interests. I agreed to everything, did nothing, and waited 2 more weeks to see her again. It was at this checkup that I asked her out. I knew I was fat and miserable looking, and I really don't know where I got the nerve, but I did, and she accepted. When I picked her up Saturday night, she had more pamphlets, along with journal articles on diet, the heart, exercise, and grieving. I hadn't had this much attention in a long time. We started going out, and pretty soon we were getting serious about each other. I thought Nancy was going to make all the pain go away from me. She sure tried, I'll say that. I even moved out of my apartment and into hers. She made a big deal of cooking low-cholesterol meals and watching everything I ate. She even made me lunches to take to work, although I wasn't eating anything close to what I had been consuming all those nights alone in front of the TV. I wasn't losing either. I just stayed the same, no fatter, no thinner. I tell you, Nancy was working a lot harder than I was to get me to lose that weight. We both sort of acted like it was her project, her responsibility to make me better. Actually, I think I have a metabolism that requires strenuous exercise in order for me to burn up calories efficiently, and I wasn't getting much exercise at all. Nancy played golf, and I would play with her a bit, but it just wasn't my game. After we'd been together about 8 months, I made a business trip back to Evanston, my hometown. Sure enough, after being there 2 days, I ran into a couple of friends from high school. I hadn't wanted to see anyone, looking the way I did, but these guys were old friends, and we had a lot to talk about. They were surprised to hear about my divorce. My wife was a hometown girl, too. Anyway, they talked me into playing a set of tennis. They both played, and they knew it was my game from high school. I didn't think I could last through a single game and told them so, but they insisted. It felt so good to be playing again, even though the extra pounds really slowed me down, and I lost every game I played. I told them I'd be back next year to whip them both. When I got home, Nancy told me she'd gone to this great seminar on nutrition, and she wanted me to try out all this new stuff she'd learned. I told her no, that I was going to do it my own way for a while. Now, Nancy and I had never fought. Sure, she fussed over me a lot and was constantly on me to take better care of myself, but it wasn't until I started playing tennis again that she and I began to squabble. I played at noon, so it didn't take away from the time we spent together, but she and I were never the same. Nancy is an attractive gal, about 8 years younger than I am, and once I began to shape up, I thought we'd get along better than ever because she'd be proud of me. God knows I felt better about myself. But it sure didn't work that way. She complained that I just wasn't the same anymore and finally asked me to move out. By that time, I weighed only 7 pounds more than I had before the divorce. It was really hard for me to leave her. I'd hoped we would eventually get married, but once I was thinner, she was right. It just wasn't the same between us anymore.
Tyler's attraction to Nancy. Tyler was a man with rather pronounced dependency needs, which were exaggerated by the crisis of the divorce. His almost deliberate deterioration, calculated to arouse his wife's pity and solicitude, failed with her, but nevertheless attracted a woman who loved too much, who made another's well-being the core of her purpose in life. His helplessness and pain and her eagerness to help were the basis for their mutual attraction. Tyler was still smarting from his wife's rejection, as well as deeply grieving for the loss of her and the end of their marriage. In this unhappy state, common to all those struggling through the throes of separation, he was attracted not so much to Nancy as a person, as to her role of nurse and healer, and to the surcease from suffering that she seemed to offer. Much in the same way he had used great quantities of food to fill his emptiness and smother his loss, he now used Nancy's hovering solicitude to provide a sense of emotional security and bolster his damaged self-worth. But Tyler's need for Nancy's total attention was temporary, a passing phase in his healing process. As time worked its magic, replacing self-obsession and self-pity with healthier self-assertion, Nancy's overprotection, once comforting, now became cloying. Unlike Tyler's temporarily exaggerated dependency, her need to be needed was not a passing phase, but rather a core trait in her personality and almost her sole framework for relating to another person. She was nurse, both at work and at home. Though Tyler would still be a fairly dependent partner even after recovery from the shock of divorce, the depth of his need to be taken care of could not match the depth of her need to manage and control another's life. His health, for which she had seemed to work tirelessly, was actually the death knell for their relationship. Bart, 36, former executive, alcoholic since the age of 14, sober 2 years.
I'd been divorced and out doing the singles scene for about a year when I met Rita. She was this long-legged, dark-eyed, hippie-looking girl. And at first, we got stoned a lot together. I had lots of money still, and we really had a great time for a while. But you know, Rita was never really a hippie. She was too responsible to let go much. She could smoke a little dope with me, but somehow her proper Bostonian background would never totally disappear. Even her apartment was neat all the time. I had this sense of being safe with her, as if she wouldn't let me fall too far. The first night we went out, we had a great dinner, and then came back to her apartment. I got really drunk, and I guess I passed out. Anyway, I woke up on her couch, all covered up with this nice, soft quilt, and my head was on a pillow that was scented, and I just felt as if I'd come home. A safe harbor, you know? Rita knew all about taking care of alcoholics. Her father, a banker, had died from his disease. Anyway, I moved in with her a few weeks after that and came on like the hotshot wheeler-dealer for the next couple of years, for as long as I could get away with it, until I lost everything. She had quit doing any dope at all after about the first 6 months we were together. I guess she figured she'd better keep on top of things because I was so out of it. In the middle of all this, we got married. Then I got really scared. Now I had another responsibility, and I hadn't done so well with responsibility. Besides, right about the time we got married, I was losing everything financially. I just couldn't hold it together anymore in the shape I was in, drinking all day long. Rita didn't know it was that bad because I'd tell her I was going to a business meeting in the morning, and instead, I'd drive out in my Mercedes and park by the beach and drink. Finally, when the bottom really fell out of the business, and I owed everybody in town, I didn't know what to do. I took off on a long trip, intending to kill myself in my car and make it look like an accident. But she came after me, found me in this sleazy hotel, and took me home. All the money was gone, but she still got me into an alcoholism treatment hospital. It's funny, but I wasn't grateful. I was angry, confused, very scared, and totally turned off to her sexually for about the first year of sobriety. I still don't know if we'll make it, but it's getting a little better as time goes by.
Bart's attraction to Rita. When on their first date, Bart got drunk and passed out, Rita, by making sure that he didn't suffer, seemed to promise him a respite from his headlong rush toward self-destruction. For a while, it looked as though she might be able to protect him from the ravages of his own addiction, to subtly and sweetly save him. This seemingly protective attitude actually served to lengthen the time that her partner could practice his addiction and not feel the consequences. By shielding and comforting him, she helped him stay sick longer. An addict who is practicing his disease isn't looking for someone to help him get well. He's looking for someone with whom he can stay sick, safely. Rita was perfect for a while, until Bart got so sick even she couldn't undo what he was doing to himself. When she tracked him down and entered him into a hospital program for alcoholics, Bart began to give up alcohol and recover. Rita, however, had come between him and his drug. She was no longer performing her usual role of comforting him and making everything all right, and he resented her for that apparent betrayal, and also for appearing to be so strong when he felt so weak and helpless. No matter how badly we are botching the job, each of us needs to feel that we are in charge of our own life. When someone helps us, we often resent that person's implied power and superiority. Moreover, a man often needs to feel stronger than his female partner in order to feel sexually attracted to her. In this case, the help Rita gave Bart by getting him into a hospital only made it clear how very sick he was, and her deeply caring gesture thus undermined, at least for a while, his sexual attraction to her. Besides this emotional aspect, there may also be an important physiological factor operating here that should be taken into consideration. When a man has been using alcohol and other drugs the way Bart did, and then stops, it sometimes takes a year or more for his body chemistry to right itself and for him to respond sexually in a normal fashion, without the presence of a drug in his system. During this period of physical adjustment, the couple may have considerable difficulty understanding and accepting his lack of interest and/or inability to perform sexually. The opposite can also occur. An unusually strong sex drive may develop in the newly clean and sober addict, perhaps due to hormonal disequilibrium. Or again, the reason may be more psychological. As one young man, abstinent from alcohol and other drugs for a few weeks, put it, "Sex is the only way I can get high now." Sex may thus be substituted for the use of a drug to relieve the anxiety that is typical in early sobriety. Recovery from addiction and co-addiction, is an extremely complex and delicate process for a couple. Bart and Rita might survive that transition, even though they originally came together because their diseases of alcoholism and codependency called to each other. But to make it as a couple in the absence of active addiction, they must walk separate paths for a while, each focusing on his or her own recovery. They must each look within and embrace the self they tried so hard through loving each other, dancing with each other, to avoid. Greg, 38, clean and sober for 14 years in Narcotics Anonymous, now married with 2 children and working as a counselor to young drug abusers.
We met in the park one day. She was reading an underground newspaper and I was just sort of spacing out. It was a Saturday in summer, around noon, really hot and quiet. I was 22 and had dropped out of college my first year, but I kept making noises that I was going to go back. That was so my parents would keep on sending me money. They couldn't let go of their dream that I would finish school and enter a profession, so they bailed me out for a long time. Alana was pretty fat, about 40 or 50 pounds overweight, which meant she wasn't a threat to me, because she wasn't perfect. If she rejected me, it wouldn't count. I started a conversation with her about what she was reading, and it was easy, right from the beginning. She laughed a lot, which made me feel as if I was this charming, entertaining guy. She told me about Mississippi and Alabama and marching with Martin Luther King and what it had been like, working with all these people who were trying to make a difference. I'd never been committed to anything except having a good time. Getting high and getting by was my motto. And I was much better at getting high than getting by. Alana was so intense. She said she loved being back in California, but that sometimes she felt she didn't have the right to be so comfortable when other people in this country were suffering. We sat in the park together for 2 or 3 hours that day, just kind of drifting along, telling each other more and more about who we were. After a while, we went back to the house I shared to get stoned, but when we got there, she was hungry. She started eating and cleaning the kitchen while I was getting loaded in the living room. There was music on, and I remember she came out with this jar of peanut butter, these crackers and a knife, and sat down real close to me. We just laughed and laughed. I think in that moment we both let ourselves be seen as addicts, more clearly than we ever did after that day. There were no excuses then, just the behaviors. And we were both doing exactly what we wanted to do. Plus, we'd found someone who wouldn't give us a hard time about it. Without saying a word, we knew it was going to work for us to be together. We had a lot of good times after that, but I don't think there was ever another time when it was all so easy, when both of us were so free of defenses. Addicts are pretty defensive people. I remember we used to fight a lot about whether I could make love to her without being stoned. She was sure she was repulsive because she was fat. When I got loaded before we made love, she thought I had to, in order to stand it. Actually, I had to be stoned in order to make love to anybody. We both had pretty low self-esteem. It was easy for me to hide behind her addiction because her weight showed that there was a problem. My lack of motivation and the fact that my life was going nowhere were less obvious than those 50 pounds she was carrying around. So there we'd be, fighting over whether I could really love her, even though she was heavy. She'd get me to say that it was who she was inside that counted, not how she looked, and then there would be peace for a while. She said she ate because she was so unhappy. I said I got loaded because I couldn't make her happy. In this really sick way, we were perfect foils for each other. We each had an excuse for what we were doing. Most of the time, we pretended there were no real problems, though. After all, lots of people are fat, and lots of people get loaded. So we'd just ignore the whole thing. Then I got arrested for possession of dangerous drugs. I spent 10 days in jail, and my parents got me a hotshot attorney who got me into counseling as an alternative to more jail time. Alana moved out while I was locked up for those 10 days. I was so angry. I felt she'd abandoned me. Actually, we were fighting more and more. When I look back now, I realize I was becoming pretty hard to live with. The paranoia that develops in people who do drugs for any length of time had been really beginning to affect me. Also, I was either loaded or wanting to get loaded almost all of the time. Alana had been taking all of it personally, thinking that if she were only different, I would want to be more present with her, not stoned every minute. She thought I was avoiding her. Hell, I was avoiding myself. Anyway, she disappeared for about 10 months, on another march, I think. The counselor I saw insisted that I go to Narcotics Anonymous meetings. Since it was either that or jail, I went. I saw some people there I had known from the street, and after a while it began to dawn on me that I just might have a problem with drugs. These people were getting on with life, and I was still getting stoned every day, all day. So I stopped bullshitting my way through meetings, and I asked one guy I thought a lot of if he'd help me. He became my sponsor in NA, and I'd call him twice a day, morning and night. It meant changing everything I did, friends, parties, everything. But I did it. The counseling helped, too, because that counselor knew everything I was going to go through before I did, and he'd warned me. Anyway, it worked, and I was able to stay away from drugs and alcohol. Alana came back when I'd been clean and sober in NA for 4 months, and right away it was the same old thing. We had this game we played together. The counselor called it colluding. It was our way of using each other to feel good or bad about ourselves, and of course to practice our addictions. I knew I'd get loaded if I got into all that behavior with her. Now we're not even friends anymore. It just didn't work if we couldn't be sick together.
Greg's attraction to Alana. Greg and Alana shared a powerful bond right from the beginning. They each had an addiction that was ruling their lives, and from the first day they met, they focused on each other's addiction to diminish, in comparison, the importance and power of their own. Then, throughout their relationship, they subtly and not so subtly exchanged permission with each other to stay sick, even while protesting each other's condition. This is an extremely common pattern with addictive couples, whether they are addicted to the same substance or to different ones. They use each other's behavior and problems to avoid facing the seriousness of their own deterioration. And the greater the deterioration, the more this partner is needed to provide a distraction, to be even sicker, even more obsessed, even less in control. Along with this dynamic, Alana appeared to Greg as compassionate, willing to suffer for something she believed in. This always has a magnetic allure for an addictive person, because a willingness to suffer is a prerequisite for a relationship with an addict. It guarantees that the addict won't be abandoned when things inevitably start to go bad. After long months of bitter quarreling, it was still only when Greg was gone, doing time in jail, that Alana found the strength to leave him, even temporarily. She inevitably returned, ready to begin again where they had left off, as two practicing addicts. Greg and Alana knew only how to be sick together. With Alana's own addiction to food still out of control, she could feel strong and healthy only if Greg were constantly loaded, just as he could feel his drug use was coolly self-controlled compared to her binges with food and extreme overweight. Greg's recovery made her lack of recovery too obvious for them to be comfortable together any longer. She would have needed to sabotage his sobriety in order for them to return to a workable status quo.
Eric, 42, divorced and remarried.
I'd been divorced a year and a half when I met Sue. An instructor at the community college where I coach football had twisted my arm to come to his housewarming, so there I was, on Sunday afternoon, sitting alone in the master bedroom, watching a Rams 49ers game while everyone else was out in the living room, enjoying the party. Sue came in to put down her coat, and we said hello. She left and then, half an hour later, came back to see if I was still there. She teased me some about holing up all alone in the back room with the TV, and during the commercial we chatted a bit. Well, she left again and came back with a plate of everything good that was being served out where the party was going on. I looked at her then, really for the first time, and noticed how pretty she was. When the game was over, I joined the party, but she had gone. I found out that she was a part-time instructor for the English department, so On Monday, I stopped in at her office and asked her to let me pay her back for the lunch she'd brought me. She said sure, if we could go somewhere with no TV. And we both laughed, but it wasn't really a joke. It would not be an overstatement to say that when I met Sue, sports were my whole life. That's the thing about sports. If you want to, you can pay total attention to them and not have any time left over for anything else. I ran every day. I trained for marathons. I coached my players and traveled with them to games. I followed sports on TV. I worked out. But I was also lonely, and Sue was very appealing. Right from the beginning, she paid a lot of attention to me when I wanted it, and yet didn't interfere with what I wanted or needed to do. She had a son, Tim, who was 6, and I liked him okay, too. Her ex lived out of state and rarely saw the boy, so it was easy for him and me to be friends. I could tell Tim wanted to be around a man. Sue and I got married after we'd known each other a year, but pretty soon things started going wrong between us. She complained that I never paid attention to her or Tim, that I was always gone and that when I was home, all I cared about was watching sports on TV. I complained that all she did was nag me and that she had known what I was like when she met me. If she didn't like it, what was she doing here? I was mad at Sue a lot of the time, but somehow I couldn't be mad at Tim, too. And I knew that the way she and I were fighting was hurting him. Though I never would admit it then, Sue was right. I was avoiding her and Tim. Sports gave me something to do, something to talk about and think about that was safe and comfortable. I'd grown up in a family where sports was the only topic you could discuss with my father, the only way you could get his attention. It was pretty much all I knew about being a man. Well, Sue and I were just about ready to split up. We were fighting so much. The more she'd pressure me, the more I'd tune her out and escape into my running or the ball games or whatever. Then one Sunday afternoon, the Miami Dolphins and the Oakland Raiders were in a playoff, and the phone rang. Sue was out with Tim, and I remembered how annoyed I felt at the interruption and having to get up and leave the TV. The call was from my brother, telling me that my father had had a heart attack and that he was dead. I went to the funeral without Sue. We were fighting so much I wanted to go alone, and I'm glad I did. Going back there changed my whole life. Here I was at my father's funeral, never having been able to talk to him and on the brink of my second divorce because I didn't know how to relate to my wife either. I felt like I was losing so much, and I couldn't understand why it was all happening to me. I was a nice guy. I worked hard. I never hurt anybody. I felt sorry for myself and totally alone. I rode back from the funeral with my youngest brother. He couldn't quit crying. He kept talking about how it was too late now, that he'd never be close to our father. Then, back at the house, everybody was talking about Dad. You know how you do after a funeral. And people kept making these little jokes about Dad and sports. How much he loved them. How he was always watching them. My brother-in-law, trying to be funny, said, "You know, this is the first time I've been in this house when the TV wasn't on and he wasn't watching a game." I looked at my brother and he started to cry again. Not sadly, but bitterly. All of a sudden, I saw what my father had done all his life, and what I was doing, too. Just like him, I wouldn't let anybody be close to me, know me, talk to me. The TV was my armor. I followed my brother outside, and we took a drive together down to the lake. We sat there for a long time. As I listened to him talk about how long he'd been waiting for Dad to notice him, I started really seeing myself for the first time, realizing how much I'd become like my father. I thought about my stepson, Tim, always waiting like a sad little puppy for some of my time and attention, and how I had kept myself too busy for him or his mom. On the plane ride home, I kept thinking about what I wanted people to say about me when I died, and that helped me see what I had to do. Back home with Sue, I talked honestly, maybe for the first time in my whole life. We cried together and called Tim in to be with us. And he cried too. After that, everything was wonderful for a while. We did things together, bike rides and picnics with Tim. We went out and we had friends in. It was hard for me to back off the whole sports thing, but I had to quit almost cold turkey for a while to get everything in perspective. I really wanted to be close to the people I loved, not to die and leave people feeling the way my father had. But it turned out to be harder for Sue than for me. After a couple of months had gone by, she told me that she was going to take a part-time job on weekends. I couldn't believe it. That was our time to spend together. Now everything was becoming reversed. She was running away from me. We both agreed to get some help. In counseling, Sue admitted that all our togetherness had been driving her crazy, that she felt like she didn't know how to do it, how to be with me. We both talked about how hard it was to really be with another person. Even though she'd nagged me about my old behavior, she now got uncomfortable when I paid attention to her. She wasn't used to it. If anything, her family had been worse than mine in the attention-affection department. Her father, a ship's captain, was always gone, and her mother liked it that way. Sue had grown up lonely, always wanting to be close to someone, but like me, she didn't know how. We stayed in counseling for a while, and at the therapist's suggestion, we joined the Stepfamily Association. As Tim and I got closer, Sue had trouble letting me discipline him. She felt left out and like she was losing control of him, but I knew I had to set my own limits with Tim if he and I were really going to have a relationship. Being in that association helped me more than anything else. They had group meetings for families like ours. Listening to other men struggling with their feelings was great for me. It helped me keep talking about mine to Sue. We're still talking, and we're still together, learning how to be close and to trust each other. Neither of us is as good at it as we'd like to be, but we keep practicing. It's a brand new game for both of us.
Eric's attraction to Sue. Eric, lonely in his self-imposed isolation, yearned to be loved and cared for without having to risk closeness. When Sue approached him on the day they met, tacitly signaling her acceptance of his chief means of avoidance, his obsession with sports, Eric wondered if he hadn't actually found his ideal woman, one who would care for him and yet leave him alone. Though Sue subtly complained about his inattention by pointedly suggesting that their first date be away from a TV, he still correctly assumed she had a high tolerance for distance. Otherwise, she would have avoided him in the first place. Actually, Eric's blatant lack of social skills and his inability to relate emotionally were attractive elements to Sue. His clumsiness both endeared him to her and assured her that he wouldn't be able to reach out to other people, including other women, and that was important. Sue, like so many women who love too much, deeply feared abandonment. Better to be with someone who didn't quite meet her needs, but whom she wouldn't lose, than with someone more loving and more lovable, who might leave her for someone else. Also, Eric's social isolation provided her with a job to do, to bridge the chasm that stretched between him and other people. She could interpret him and his idiosyncrasies to the rest of the world, attributing to shyness rather than indifference his retreat from social contact. Simply put, he needed her. Sue, on the other hand, was letting herself in for a situation that would replicate all the worst aspects of her childhood years, the loneliness, the hopeful waiting for love and attention, the deep disappointment, and finally, the angry despair. As she tried to force Eric to change, her behavior only confirmed his fears about relationships and caused him to retreat further. But Eric did change dramatically due to a series of profoundly moving events in his life. He became willing to face his dragon, his fear of closeness, in order to avoid becoming another version of his cold, unapproachable father. That he so strongly identified with lonely little Tim was a major factor in his commitment to change, But this change in him forced a change in each member of the family. Sue catapulted from being ignored and avoided to being pursued and courted, was forced to face her own discomfort with actually receiving the loving attention she craved.